Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
At National Bank, we're here to level up your reality.
Does that mean I can move from my parents' basement into my own apartment?
It's possible. We can even help you swap your backyard for a travel destination of your choice.
And if I wanted to buy my first car?
Sure. Let's see what we can do for you. We're here to level up your reality. National Bank.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We're recording this at 14 hours GMT on Monday, the 12th of June. The master showman and survivor of Italian politics, former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, has died at the age of 86. Ukraine says it's retaken several villages from the Russian occupiers. And
the stigma tends to affect women, so it's very hard for us to talk about it to begin with. Also, we live in a society that believes it is safer for women to keep quiet rather than speak out.
How one group of women is challenging the stigma of sexual abuse in Japan. Also in the podcast,
she always took care of them. She gave them flour and cassava bread, any fruit in the bush. They know what they must consume. God is great.
We find out more about how four children survived 40 days in the Colombian jungle after their plane crashed. Before Donald Trump, there was Silvio Berlusconi, a flamboyant showman, property magnate and media tycoon. He dominated Italian politics for the best part of two decades, winning three elections and becoming the longest-serving prime minister since the war. Today it was announced that Silvio Berlusconi had died at the age of 86, and tributes have been coming in from around the world. A right-wing populist, he was a divisive figure, infamous for his bunga bunga parties and subject of mockery on the global stage. But he remained relevant in Italy, bouncing back from sex and corruption scandals and even a conviction to secure a place in the current government for his party Forza Italia. Mark Duff looks back at his life and career.
A jingle from Silvio Berlusconi's 2008 election campaign. Its refrain, basically, thank goodness for Silvio, goes to the heart of his appeal. Light-hearted, cheeky even, but all cover for a sharp intelligence and ruthless ambition. To the outside world, he seemed something of a buffoon. We either smirked at his gaffes or scowled at the alleged corruption, the apparent homophobia and racism, and his undoubted eye for a pretty face. This was, after all, the man who'd gone from cruise ship crooner to hosting sex parties at his palatial villa outside Milan.
Complimenti, siete così bravi che mi viene voglia di invitarvi al bunga bunga.
My compliments. You are so good, I am almost forced to invite you for some bunga bunga.
Behind the affable mask lurked a man on a mission, the prophet of a new way of doing politics.
Berlusconi was the first to apply commercial marketing techniques to politics, right? 30 years down the line, it doesn't sound all that new or all that surprising, but back then it indeed was.
Lucia Rubinelli teaches political science at Yale. Silvio Berlusconi, she says, spotted the potential of television and advertising as a means of making money first and fast, but also as a way to power.
He came along at the time when the two major Italian political parties since the war, the Communist Party and the Christian Democratic Party, were both collapsing. He presented himself as somebody who, having succeeded in the world of business, could be equally, if not more, successful in the field of politics.
For years, he lived a charmed life. Questions about the initial source of his wealth, allegations of mafia links, of corruption and tax avoidance, all seemed to come and go, leaving barely a judicial mark on the man.
The Italian Prime Minister, Silvio Berlusconi, has been ordered to stand trial on charges of paying for sex with a 17-year-old teenager.
This was perhaps the moment the magic began to fade.
This is the teenage dancer sharing the spotlight of scandal with the Prime Minister, known by her nickname of Ruby.
Ruby wasn't the only woman to ruffle Silvio Berlusconi's feathers. When the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, was caught on camera smirking about him with the French President, Nicolas Sarkozy, the loss of face, the bruta figura, was terminal. Less than a month after they pulled rank on him, forcing Italy to fall in line with strict EU financial guidelines, Berlusconi was gone.
Mi hanno raccontato una barzelletta su Hitler che è terribile.
Silvio Berlusconi never lost his sense of fun. But there's no dodging the fact that, at times, that in itself provided cover for darker forces. Here he is, joking with young supporters about, of all things, Adolf Hitler.
La prossima volta... Cattivi, eh?
Such humour wasn't simply inappropriate, says Lucia Rubinelli. It was dangerous.
In his typical way of, you know, just dropping a headline here and making a joke, he slowly started to send the message that, well, you know, after all, fascism wasn't all that bad. And in fact, Mussolini did good things. And this message, time after time after time, ultimately made possible having a prime minister who comes directly from the milieu of post-fascist movement.
Last year saw Mr. Berlusconi's party join a government led by the far right's Giorgia Meloni. But when he dared criticise her, she struck right back. At least I'm not blackmailable, she said. The ultimate ladies' man, finally put firmly in his place by Italy's first female Prime Minister.
Mark Duff. But following the death of Silvio Berlusconi, Giorgia Meloni put aside their differences, saying that he was one of the most influential men in Italy's history. The Russian president, meanwhile, Vladimir Putin, with whom Mr. Berlusconi maintained close ties even after the invasion of Ukraine, called him a true friend. The former centre-left Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi summed up his divisive nature, saying Mr. Berlusconi was a character who was both loved and hated. Before Ukraine launched its counter-offensive against the Russians a week ago, it was keen to stress the importance of operational secrecy, putting out a video with soldiers holding their fingers to their lips. But now Ukrainian armed forces have been trumpeting a series of victories, with three villages reportedly liberated on Sunday and another two today. A video was released apparently showing Ukrainian troops in Storozhevo holding up the yellow and blue flag of Ukraine. Glory to Ukraine, shouts one soldier. Others reply, glory, glory, glory to the Marine infantry. Well, for its part, Russia says it's inflicted heavy losses on the Ukrainians. So how is the counter-offensive going? Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, has this analysis.
There are layers of Russian defence. This has been revealed from satellite pictures. And part of the idea behind this is that it can channel an invading force into killing zones where they can be hit by artillery. The sort of the nightmare for Ukrainians would be if the Russians did a counterattack and pushed back. But I think it's quite clear that they're not capable of that kind of manoeuvre themselves. But they may well be capable of fighting from these fixed positions. The thing about this offensive, and it was talked about for such a long time, but it's not going to end the war. Even at the most optimistic estimate from the Ukrainian side, they want to cut this connection that they have, the Russians have, between the area around Donbass in the east of Ukraine and that border down to the Crimean Peninsula, which is a big swathe of territory. But that is a big ask on its own.
Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen. Ukraine and Russia will also be facing off in the courtroom today at the International Court of Justice in The Hague, not over the invasion but the shooting down of a passenger plane after Russia's previous incursion in Ukraine in 2014. The hearing is due to start as we record this podcast. The court has ruled that pro-Russian separatists were responsible for downing Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 over eastern Ukraine. Ukraine has argued that Russia itself also bears responsibility, something Moscow denies. Our correspondent in The Hague, Anna Holligan, sent this report.
This is Kyiv's opportunity to try to convince the ICJ's 16-judge panel that the Kremlin knowingly provided heavy artillery to groups which carried out numerous acts of terror. among them shooting down the Malaysia Airlines plane, resulting in the deaths of all 298 people on board. Last week, the British barrister representing Moscow argued that without proven intent, there was no violation of the anti-terrorism convention. The case is being heard inside the Peace Palace, built as a worldwide icon of peace through law. Despite these two nations being at war, their representatives have been seated just metres apart inside the courtroom. For some people, this represents a hope for justice, when most other avenues seem beyond reach.
Anna Holligan in The Hague. A major data breach has been reported in India. Media there say the personal details of hundreds of thousands of people who'd registered for COVID vaccines have been leaked. Our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Etirajan is following the story.
An Indian news website, the News Minute, says it was able to access names, birth dates and passport numbers of some prominent people by entering their mobile phone numbers on the Telegram app using a software program. It said it had also verified the information with some politicians whose details have appeared on the app. A consumer awareness group described the leak as a digital infrastructure disaster. But a senior Indian health authority official has strongly rejected the possibility of a data breach.
Anbarasan Etirajan. Japan is preparing to raise its age of consent from 13 to 16 as part of an overhaul of its laws on sexual offences currently going through Parliament. The world's third largest economy currently has the lowest consent age among the group of seven leading democracies. The current laws also discourage women from coming forward to report sexual crimes, putting the onus on rape victims to prove they were subjected to violence and intimidation. The reforms come after several rape acquittals in 2019 caused public outrage and helped fuel a protest movement called the Flower Demo. Our Japan correspondent Shaima Khalil has been talking to some of the women challenging stigma.
It's a chilly evening here at the plaza outside the old and beautifully lit Tokyo train station building, a very popular background for wedding photos. On the other side of the plaza is a small gathering, and the mood could not be more different. A few women and men are carrying placards. One says sexual abuse is unforgivable. Another says consent is everything. A woman now is standing in the center, taking the microphone. For 4 years, sexual violence survivors have gathered on the 11th of every month in the central Tokyo spot to share their stories. Now remember, this is very unusual for Japan, a country where the vast majority of survivors keep quiet out of shame and fear. What's now known as the Flower Demo has become a national movement after a series of high-profile rape acquittals in 2019. Its founder, Minori Kitahara, tells me she started this because there was no other place for women's voices.
I've met so many sexual abuse victims who said it's been their goal to come and speak here. Knowing that the Flower Demo has become such an important place for so many people, I feel I have a responsibility to protect the movement.
Why is it so difficult for women to speak out against sexual violence here in Japan?
The stigma tends to affect women, so it's very hard for us to talk about it to begin with. Also, we live in a society that believes it is safer for women to keep quiet rather than speak out.
A recent survey showed that more than 70% of sexual attacks go unreported here. So when Rina Gunoy decided to speak out, she knew it wasn't going to be easy. Especially that she was standing up in the face of Japan's military institution, the Self-Defense Forces, or the SDF. Rina tells me she had two dreams, to be a soldier and to compete in the Olympics as a judo player. Both were within reach when she joined the military, and both were shattered by sexual harassment.
My breasts were rubbed, I was kissed on the cheek, groped in the hallway with people watching. This happened to me every day.
But August 2021 was a dark turning point. During a training exercise in the mountains, three male soldiers called her into a tent where they'd been drinking.
Two superiors were talking about martial arts and said I should try it. One of my colleagues pinned me down on the bed and choked me. He spread my legs and rubbed his crotch against me like it was a sex act. Two others did the same. There were about a dozen soldiers around. No one stopped it. They were laughing. I was filled with despair. I'd hoped that my female superior would stand by me when I reported the incident. but she took the side of a commander.
In the end, Rina quit the military and shared her story publicly. Despite the backlash and threats she faced, she collected more than 100,000 signatures, calling on the Defense Ministry to conduct a thorough investigation. This was one of the rare cases that captured the media's and the nation's imagination. Rina tells me many women and men got in touch with her to share their stories of sexual assault and abuse, both inside the military and elsewhere. The Defense Ministry launched an internal probe last year, which confirmed Rina's claims. Five servicemen were fired for misconduct, and the ministry issued an apology. Rina says that even though she's still traumatized, she feels her fight has finally paid off, and hopes this prompts real change within the military institution.
I like the SDF so much, especially because they helped my family and I during the 2011 earthquake disaster. So this was really the last thing I wanted to do. But also, I didn't want any other female members who joined the military to experience the same thing.
Japan prides itself in being one of the world's safest places. But in this male-dominated society, many women are still struggling not to be shamed into silence.
Our Tokyo correspondent, Shaima Khalil. And still to come on the Global News podcast...
The little rat runs, especially in the city of London, were really important. But a lot of them were shut down there. And this is why I think sometimes you see the private hire drivers having trouble getting around, because you really need that knowledge.
How rules might change for drivers of London's famous black taxis. Australian police have charged a 58-year-old bus driver after a fatal crash. 10 people were killed when the vehicle overturned late on Sunday evening after a wedding in the wine region of the Hunter Valley. Our correspondent in Sydney, Phil Mercer, told us it was a terrible day for Australia.
This is one of the country's worst road accidents in decades, possibly ever, given that at least 10 people have been killed after this bus rolled over at a roundabout on a busy highway in the Hunter Valley, which is a couple of hours' drive to the north of Sydney. And a scientific investigation and a police inquiry are hoping to establish exactly what happened and why. We know that the bus flipped over around 11:30 p.m. local time on Sunday evening. There were reports at the time that the weather was pretty foggy. 25 people were taken to hospital. Mercifully, some of them have been discharged, but we know that at least one person is very seriously ill. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese gave a press conference in Canberra a few hours ago.
All of us know the joy of going to a wedding, a chance to celebrate dear friends and family. They are some of the happiest times that you can have. For a joyous day like that in a beautiful place to end with such terrible loss of life and injury is so cruel and so sad and so unfair. People hire a bus for weddings in order to keep their guests safe. And that just adds to the unimaginable nature of this tragedy.
And when you look at where the wedding guests were from, all over eastern Australia, from here in New South Wales, further north in Queensland and further south in the state of Victoria, the ripples of grief stemming from this tragedy will flow far and wide. So Mr. Albanese, the Prime Minister, saying that the whole country is standing with those people who are involved in this terrible accident, as we say, one of the worst accidents in Australian history.
Phil Mercer in Sydney. Thousands of forums on the social media platform Reddit are being made inaccessible for 48 hours as part of a protest by volunteer moderators. These are vital to the running of the site's communities or subreddits, but they're unhappy at plans to introduce fees for the developers of third-party apps, which they say could end up costing them millions. Our technology editor Zoe Kleinman explains.
There are thousands of these channels on Reddit. They're called subreddits. And anyone can start one up. And some of them have millions of people following them, you know, 30, 40 million people. So if you start one, it can be about anything you want, but you have to moderate it. And if you've got this enormous channel with millions of people talking on it, you know, that becomes a bit of a full-time job. But now this row is kicking off because there's a bit of computer code called an API, which every digital platform has, and it's how other apps access it. So, for example, if you use a social media manager, it's using the API to access all of the social networks that you want to view. Traditionally, these have been left open for developers and app makers to use for free. But Reddit wants to start charging for it. Now, some of these apps, these alternative apps, are really popular. They're used by millions of people. And almost all of them have said they can't afford it and they're going to have to close. Reddit says it wants to stop big tech from using its data to train AI tools. It says its data is really valuable. Why should it give it all away for free? But the Reddit moderators don't get paid. And they feel that Reddit is profiting from their goodwill here and making a lot of money when they're not getting anything out of it. And that's why I think 6,000 of these channels now are going dark, so you won't be able to see them. So the thing is, this API becomes worth a lot less because there's nothing to see on it. There's no data to see.
Our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman. Now, it may not be quite as dramatic as the TV show Succession, but George Soros has made a decision to hand over his $25 billion empire to his 37-year-old son, Alex, despite saying in the past he didn't want one of his five kids to succeed him. When asked about his U-turn, the 92-year-old philanthropist said his son had earned it. Alex Soros has said he is more political than his father and plans to continue helping left-leaning causes. But at the same time, he said, "Our side has to be better about being more patriotic and inclusive. Just because someone votes Trump doesn't mean they're lost or racist." I heard more about George Soros's decision from our business correspondent, Katie Silver.
He initially said that it was basically he wanted to get the best person for the job. But he says now, for example, that Alex, which is his second youngest of his five children, he says that he's earned it. He has, for example, recently been taking trips for the organization's office around the world. He sits on the board, for example, the Soros Fund Management, which manages about $25 billion for the family, as well as the charitable foundation. And he has been the chairman since December of this big philanthropic organization, the Open Society Foundation. So perhaps, as I say, he says that he feels like he's earned it, and maybe he sees that he can indeed take the reins. There was definitely a lot of questions as to whether or not he was even going to pass the reins over to anybody whilst he was still alive.
Yeah, so Alex Soros has obviously been involved at least recently. What more do we know about him?
Well, he's got a PhD in history. He's 37, so still pretty young. And he has said by his own admission that he has broadly the same political views as his father, but that he is more political. And, for example, that he's going to actively campaign against Donald Trump's attempt to run as a second term for the US president. He says, for example, that he shares a lot of the same ideas around democracy that his dad does. That includes, for example, a commitment to try and pursue freedom of speech, criminal justice reform, as well as minority and refugee rights. But he says, for example, that his focus is perhaps going to be more US focus. And of course, his dad was born in Hungary and lived under the Nazi occupation. And indeed, Open Society Foundations was headquartered initially in Budapest and then later in Berlin. Whereas it sounds like Alex is going to be more focused on US domestic politics. He says, for example, that he's going to put emphasis on voting rights, abortion, as well as initiatives when it comes to gender equality.
So George Soros handing over the top job, though, do we expect him to continue being involved?
Well, one would assume so. I mean, it's such an important project for him. Of course, as I say, he lived under the Nazi occupation. After he left Hungary, he ended up in London, later in New York, and there he went on to make billions of dollars through his hedge fund activities. At one point, for example, he made $1 billion by being correct that the pound would fall back in 1992. He was dubbed at the time the man who broke the Bank of England. But it definitely seems that given this early history, his real passion has been about trying to help support democracy building, particularly since the fall of the Berlin Wall back in the late 80s. So this is, without a doubt, his big focus. So far, for example, we see the organization spends in the order of about $1.5 billion a year across about 120 different countries trying to back these liberal causes. So one doesn't imagine, whilst we may see a change in figurehead, one doesn't imagine that George Soros is going to be completely stepping away from this organization, which has been such a pivotal part of his life's work.
Our business correspondent, Katie Silver. Now, you may have heard on a previous edition of the Global News podcast the incredible story of the rescue of four children from the Colombian jungle 40 days after their plane crashed. More details have now emerged about how they survived. Their grandmother, Fatima Valencia, told reporters how the eldest child, 13-year-old Leslie, was able to keep her three younger siblings alive, including one who was just 11 months old.
She always took care of them. She gave them flour and cassava bread, any fruit in the bush. They know what they must consume. God is great.
And their father, Manuel Miller Ranoque, said that Leslie had revealed that following the crash and before she died, their mother told them to seek help and escape.
All Leslie tells me is that her mother was alive for 4 days. Before she died, she told them something like, "You guys get out of here. You guys are going to see the kind of man your dad is, and he's going to show you the same kind of great love that I have shown you. As long as I am alive, my children will be the only memory and consolation that their mother leaves me with."
My colleague Victoria Uonkunda spoke to journalist Manuel Rueda, who has spoken to the children's grandfather.
First of all, you know, this plane crashes in the middle of the rainforest on May 1st, and the children survive the crash while the three adults who are on the plane perish in the crash. And then the children manage to survive for 40 days before they're found, which is another extremely difficult feat. So it's really extraordinary what happened. They were able to survive initially with 3 kilos of cassava flour that someone on the plane was carrying. So apparently this was their first food. Then we know that they wandered in the jungle for many days and they lived of fruits and seeds that they could find in the trees in the rainforest. Now, these are all secondhand accounts, because the children are in a hospital right now. None of the press here has been able to speak directly with the children. So this is what the relatives of the children who have visited them in the hospital are saying that the children have told them, particularly the oldest child, Leslie, who's 13 years old.
We understand that the mother may have survived with them, but unfortunately passed after 4 days.
So there's contradictory accounts of that, okay? That's what the children's father is saying. Leslie, the oldest child, told him that the mother survived for 4 days. But then on the other hand, people from the rescue team, the general who was leading the operation, the children's grandfather, say that this isn't true, that the three adults in the plane died immediately when it crashed. So, you know, because in this story, we haven't been able to speak sort of with the main characters, there's all these contradictory accounts emerging as well.
Do you think their indigenous lifestyle or way of living may have had a role to play in how they managed to survive for 40 days in the jungle alone?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I was speaking to the children's grandfather this morning, you know, and what he said is that since they're small, they're used to walking in the rainforest. They can identify the trees, the fruits that you can eat. Because it's an environment they were used to, they didn't panic.
You saying that you've spoken to their grandfather, how did the family react or how were they feeling when they found out about the children's survival?
Well, they were extremely relieved and extremely happy. I mean, this has been a very difficult 40 days for them because the plane was found on May 16th, so 2 weeks after it went down. And that's when they realized that the children's mother had died. They were going through a period of grieving. They're elated that they can see the four children in good condition, having survived this difficult ordeal. So they're very happy. They're also trying to ensure that the children have enough privacy to recover. And the children are going to be in the hospital probably for 3 weeks while they recover.
And we understand that there was a dog that found them by the name of Wilson, but there is no more information of his whereabouts. Have we found any more about that?
Right. So what happened during the search operation is that the military flew in about 150 troops to the area where the crash occurred, which is an extremely remote area. With those 150 troops, they also flew in 10 very specially trained rescue dogs, including this dog Wilson, which is a Belgian shepherd. Apparently, at some point in the search, Wilson got separated from the search party and found the children. And while the military were looking for the children, they also followed the footprints. They looked for footprints in the jungle, and they found the children's footprints next to the dog's footprints. And the children in the hospital have apparently confirmed that they spent a couple of days with the dog, which then ran away somewhere else. So the dog Wilson is still missing, and the military has said that they're still leaving some people there looking for Wilson.
Journalist Manuel Rader talking to Victoria Ornkunda. Now, along with Big Ben, Buckingham Palace and red phone boxes, one of the iconic images of London is the humble black cab. To drive one, you have to pass the knowledge, learning all the roads and routes within 10 kilometres of Charing Cross Station in central London. But amid fears of a driver shortage, there's now talk of changing the test to make it easier, as David Lewis found out.
Learning the knowledge is no easy feat. In this age of sat-nav travel, fewer students are willing to spend time scooting on mopeds learning London's landmarks, and recruits have dropped by 3,000 since 2021. So the regulator Transport for London is considering whether it can cut the time it takes for cabbies to train, possibly from an average of 4 years to two. This cab driver, Tony, thinks reducing the training is reasonable, but that the knowledge is still important.
Years ago, the little rat runs, especially in the city of London, were really important. But a lot of them are shut down there. And this is why I think sometimes you see the private hire drivers having trouble getting around, because you really need that knowledge.
The knowledge itself dates back to 1865, decades before the first petrol car. And now another change might be afoot. There's talk of leniency for drivers using sat-navs in the outer suburbs.
David Lewis. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Derek Clark and produced by David Lewis. The editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.